when I started with The Realist, I just wanted to archive the thing and read every issue and have like some sort of means of doing that. And I had no idea what I was getting involved, what I was getting involved with in terms of the content. But when we started with John, I just thought it was like this cool story about a guy who knew, you know, who was there. And I kind of knew the brief bio, The Village Voice, but I didn't even at the time know about his work with Andy Warhol. And getting into the comic, I would start to like talk to other people who were focusing on underground media for their own sort of history projects or documentaries or books, and suddenly found out about John's role with the Underground Press Syndicate, which is a huge, huge thing.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Michael O'Connell, here with another podcast about good journalism and the people who make it. Today, I'm talking to Ethan Persoff, graphic novelist, cartoonist. Welcome to the podcast, Ethan.
Hey, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Now, a few weeks back, we posted an interview with John Wilcock, the alt press pioneer who helped launch The Village Voice, and during the 1960s, hung out with Andy Warhol and helped launch Interview Magazine with Andy. Now, one of the resources that I used in researching John was a series of comic books created by Ethan and Scott Marshall. It was wonderful art, great story. So first off, you know, how did you guys get involved with John?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I first found out about John about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. There was a blog for the radio station WFMU, and they had a listing of interesting records, and one of the records they posted was this magazine called Echo Magazine, which is from the 1950s, and it was dubbed the first magazine that you could read on your turntable. And it was a series of flexi discs that were bound together like a magazine with a hole in the middle, so you could just flip a page open and drop it on your turntable, and that would be the page or the article, and then there would be text on top of that. And then just a sound piece that was that accompanied it. And I was immediately, I don't want to be over emotive, but I was immediately in love with Echo Magazine when I saw it. I noticed that the main writer on it was John and John Wilcock. And that sort of started my interest in John. And then I started to notice as I got into more underground papers and weird comics and other things that, well, specifically with weird comics, you started to notice that there was the underground comics and cartoonists of the 60s, and then there were also these sort of underground writers that would be included in fanzines along with them, or not fanzines, but I guess underground comics. And the two names sort of popped up very frequently. One was Paul Krasner, and then another was John. And I guess the way that I got most involved with John was that I started to archive Paul's, the full run of Paul's The Realist on my website. And that was a really wonderful experience. And then right at the end of it, I mentioned while I was speaking with Paul, you know, one of the columnists I've really enjoyed throughout the whole run was John, who was a really consistent contributor through The Realist, at least in the 60s side of it. And that sort of led to me and John talking.
Yeah, John is a pretty interesting, I don't want to say pretty interesting character, because he seemed to be like everywhere and knew everybody, and but was not just like a hanger-on, but it actually is a creative person as a writer and a reporter and an interviewer.
Yeah.
He was a real guy. I mean, people kind of gravitate, you know, you talk about Paul Krasner and The Realist, and you know, that's a pretty amazing publication in and of itself. But John was, you know, moving in that world. Let me back up a second. You know, you mentioned The Realist and your archiving of it. You know, what is it you liked about The Realist? That was kind of a groundbreaking satirical publication.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it was curiosity, really, because there wasn't a lot of The Realist on the web when I got to doing the archive. And so, okay, before I did The Realist, I have a website that has a bunch of different archival objects on it. And before I did The Realist, this will sound like a pun after saying The Realist, but the most realized part of the website was is a section called Comics with Problems, which is which is kind of like a double term, you know, in that they're problematic comics, and they also sort of address problems. And it's just an archive of the worst, like, government-driven comics from, like, the 40s up, you know, like things against smoking or anti-sex comics or weird moralizing religious stuff and all these things. And at one point of just sort of scanning in these often public domain comics and putting them up, I mean, I think I have about 75 of them on the site. And at one point, you kind of want to have a relationship with the creator of these things, but you really don't want to contact, if they're around, you really don't want to contact them. I kind of wanted an authorized archive of some sort, you know, where I worked with somebody and put stuff up. But with Paul, I had only seen maybe four images from the realist itself, and one of them was the Disney...
The poster.
I'm trying to be polite in the phrasing, but the Disneyland Memorial Orgy, which is a poster by Wally Wood.
Wally Wood, yeah, the famous EC comic artist.
Genius, yeah. Which is a fun Google for anybody who's listening to this out. Just look up that phrase. You'll have a fun Disneyland Memorial Orgy there. And so I wanted to put that on my site. And I also knew of Jim Lippard had a very small page archiving a segment from The Realist, but it was all text. And I wanted like to give something of a challenge to complete. And so I got in touch with Paul, and he didn't even have all the issues of The Realist. So that was its own kind of challenge, was finding every issue and beginning the archive by saying that we were going to post everything. So it started with a promise. So posting those issues actually became kind of an education in itself, because which I was eager to have. And there's a lot of really weird, interesting mental energy in those issues, especially if you read them, you know, 1 through 146.
Yeah, it's weird, and you know, there a lot of people may not be familiar with what The Realist was. I mean, I guess we could describe it as an underground satirical newspaper, maybe a little more biting than Mad Magazine or the National Lampoon. You know, maybe with a political agenda. You know, more liberal. You know, I think there's a lot of things that are in there.
Yeah, you actually described it. I think exactly where it stood. It started with the intentions of being a Mad Magazine for adults, and then I think it then thoroughly influenced National Lampoon. So you putting it between those two, that would be correct.
Yeah, and it's funny when people look back at like the, you know, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and there's sort of this manufactured counterculture that people sort of, you know, think about, that, you know, just because certain things that get much more play, that more people are aware of, but you know, there was this counterculture that was going on that the sort of the realist represented, that, you know, had a real bite to it through the 60s and 70s that, you know, you don't see a lot. And, you know, some people think about things like punk rock and, you know, alt music and things like that, that have a certain, you know, take a certain sort of stance. But, you know, that sort of edge has been around for a very long time.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned sort of like a manufactured counterculture, because I think it's funny that once counterculture became, you know, a marketing idea, money came into with like advertising or whatever. I mean, that did kind of like draw a line between authentic underground publications and sort of commercial ones. Music journalism definitely affected the life of the underground paper. I think that like Rolling Stone, as good as Rolling Stone is, I think that they are considered one of the first publications to murder other publications, because they would make, just because of the ads that they would take on from record labels. And I think they would have an exclusive control over those ads or something. I'm not fully informed on the life of that, but it is funny. Once music and other things became, you know, like it's groovy, you know, as a selling point, there was a difference between the kinds of underground papers that came after that than before. You know, and John and Paul definitely are architects of the real thing, you know, which I think informed every kind of journalism that followed it. I can talk about John's role on, well, one of the reasons with the comic that we're excited, Scott and I, and thank you for mentioning Scott's art. It really is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the goals of the comic, which I didn't, it was kind of like working with The Realist. I didn't even know this was a story when we got started with it. When I started with The Realist, I just wanted to archive the thing and read every issue and have like some sort of means of doing that. And I had no idea what I was getting involved with in terms of the content. But when we started with John, I just thought it was like this cool story about a guy who knew, you know, who was there. And I kind of knew the brief bio, the Village Voice, but I didn't even at the time know about his work with Andy Warhol. And getting into the comic, I start to like talk to other people who were focusing on underground media for their own sort of history projects or documentaries or books, and suddenly found out about John's role with the Underground Press Syndicate, which is a huge, huge thing, which was kind of this, it was a syndicate or a collection of different papers that would just agree with each other. Anybody who was a part of that syndicate could use anybody else's articles, provided they gave attribution, and there was no real... So it was like a permission system that suddenly made all these disparate papers across the country into an international sort of, and the world, into sort of like an international source of like sharing their materials. So all of a sudden, like a small city paper in the 50s, like, you know, like in Austin, we had the Rag, or New York, there would be like the Rat or the Oracle, and in San Francisco, although I think the Oracle actually stopped before UPS started, but all those papers all of a sudden could share each other's writing. And John was very much a leading architect in that. And it just, you know, I mean, it totally amplified the voice of every paper. It's just one of the small stories of like a huge impact that John had that was, you know, fascinating to me that this person, I mean, it's just one of the things that he helped create. And it definitely it created new journalism, that sort of, you know, voice where you insert yourself as a reporter into the story. And I guess like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson would be, you know, great success examples of that. But I think that modern internet is an example of that, you know.
It was almost a paper internet in that you can use sort of music as an example, because that's an easy thing I think for people to understand, that
there are these
movements that appear to have come out of nowhere, but in actuality they've been going on for a very long time with most people not noticing it. But there were people who were, you know, in journalism and in writing and in satire were sharing a lot of these different ideas and fostering it. And suddenly at some point it breaks through into the larger culture. And then, you know, as you said, you know, people like, you know, Hunter S. Thompson is like, where does he come from? You know?
Right. Right.
But in actuality, there's this thing going on. And that's kind of why it's important that, you know, what you did with Realist is, you know, that you're showing that, you know, here is the stream with which that they all drank from, that
or smoked from, I guess.
Yeah. Smoke from. Well, you know, it's funny. It's like, I remember the first time I heard, who was it? I guess it was the Sex Pistols. The first time I heard the Sex Pistols,
yeah,
it was like drinking pure alcohol, in that, you know, there's all this other stuff that I've listened to that I like, and there's a lot to talk about that, you know, it's positive. But once you hear that, or things like that, or bands like Lou Reed and his band, I can't think of the name.
The Velvet Underground.
Yeah. Once you hear those, it's like, oh my God, this is the pure stuff. And all this other stuff comes out of it and reinterprets it and sort of deadens it down. But and then as soon as you taste that and you realize that, suddenly all these connections are made in your brain. It's like, oh, okay, now this makes sense. So having a thing like The Realist, which is, you know, uber counterculture, that it has a distinctive voice that's talking throughout, you know, the 50s, 60s, or the 60s, 70s. And seeing all these other things that kind of maybe sprung out of it or were influenced by it that are much more easier for a mass audience to consume. Because, you know, you look at these issues, the Realist, they're fine, but they seem just like a step up from a fanzine in many ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, especially because they're mostly text, you know, although, and that's the funny kind of, so if somebody's just scanning it, they don't know that, like, even the most notorious thing that you mentioned, the LBJ story.
One of the most famous things that the Realist ever did was there had been, a book about the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
And,
right.
Well, go on. You know it. You're probably much more familiar with it. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Well, you set it up correctly. There was a book, a biography. I think it was a biography of Jackie Kennedy, and either recently, like newly published or was about to be published. And so the article that Paul wrote was the parts that were left out of that book. So it was supposed to be a straight piece of writing that was just sort of talking about excerpts that didn't make it into the final draft. And so you read which Jackie Kennedy's perspective and memory of certain things related to Kennedy. And so you read it and it's like pretty straight. The original was written by an English reporter and had kind of like that kind of like elegance or that kind of smoke to it when you're reading the sentences. And so about halfway through, Paul inserts an anecdote. It's just like one or two paragraphs in the whole thing, basically.
And this is the point where everybody struggles to how to relate this information to the people you're talking to.
Yeah, I think I can do it in a radio friendly way, but you know, kind of what you think are excerpts from a real book, and then one, and there are various scenes, and then all of a sudden Jackie O is on the day of the assassination, and she's with Lyndon Johnson, and she's just sort of looking over, and so you're reading also. I mean, also think that when this came out, it was like 67 or 66. And the world, and we were still sort of grieving and healing, I guess, from Kennedy being assassinated. So, I mean, I guess some parallel might be, you know, well, I don't think we even need to make metaphor. People
can understand. I think that had a huge impact on.
Yeah, it's still zeitgeist and whatever. And so she looks over and she sees that Lyndon Johnson is having a.
There is an act that is being acted upon the former president that,
you know, yeah, in a very carnal way at a very inappropriate entry point, I guess. And it just continues. And then the article continues. And one of the things that made The Realist so fantastic is there was no disclaimer there. This is satire or this isn't. And because there were legitimate pieces of news in The Realist, it has the distinction of being the first newspaper to ever report birth control pill existing. You know, Paul's a reporter to, not Puerto Rico, but Paul reported things with an exclusive journalism sense as much as he reported things with a satirical wink. And there was no disclaimer as to whether or not this was really in the book or not, the Kennedy biography. And so I think it's issue 74. If you go on the archive, you can find that out.
Yeah. And yeah, but you alluded to a couple of things there. It's satire, but you know, in order for satire to work, you need to present whatever you're presenting in a way that is recognizable and that convinces people that there's some sort of reality to it. They need to recognize that this sounds like the biography. And then when you present something totally out of the ordinary, that, you know, that's the satire. So then it's the infamous thing about that particular story was that there were many people who, because of the way they felt about Lyndon Johnson and about the assassination, they kind of believed it, or
exactly,
it was,
yeah,
within
right,
their right, the realm of, you know, yeah, I could see that happening, even, you know, this outrageous act. And so,
I can actually define how Paul described that. He did an interview with Joseph Heller, and he was talking, who did Catch 22, and he was asking Heller about certain fantastic elements that made it into the story but were plausible, even though they were so outrageous. And Heller's description of that was, it was possible but not probable. And that became sort of finding model for Paul's satirical writing.
Yeah. What we've sort of been talking around here is the fact that there's this sort of alternative narrative that's always out there,
yeah,
and that people
tap
into it. So now here we are, you know, it's 2017, you know, you're writing about John and just sort of trying to bring this to a larger audience.
Yeah, pardon me.
Yeah. So was that kind of your thinking behind doing it?
That was also just for my own thought's sake. Let me point out that Paul and I just put out a book of the cartoons from The Realist that's available from Fantagraphics right now, and it's this beautiful coffee table book. And so that's an ad for that.
That's perfectly fine.
Yeah, yeah, no, just a little plug there, but it's a wonderful book. But John actually, his own energy sort of urged the book to get made, the biography of himself. He, even at approaching 90, I've never known somebody to be so urgent and capable about, like, pushing things into a kind of being. And I think that was sort of his role in the 60s. And it was, that part of your soul doesn't really die out. And so I had mentioned to him, you know, that it would be interesting to do a comic about his stuff. And all of a sudden he was arranging to show up at my house and stay with a week while we had like this huge sort of story session for a week. I mean, literally, he showed up, not in a funny way, but he basically said, well, you know, why don't I drive over? But Most people would say that if they're across town. He was in California and I'm in Austin. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, 5 days later, he's just literally driven, you know, straight to my house to talk about the comic. And so that was part of the idea to sort of realize the comic, you know, was his own thing. But then the more we found out about it, John's story sort of starts with you thinking, you know, like, wow, he knew all these crazy people, or wow, he was there. And then there's other components to John's story that make it a really interesting narrative, because there's also the question of, well, all these people that he was around are really permanently remembered. And so how is it that John sort of gets left out of that story? And then, and the more that you learn about John, you do see, and this is represented, I think, really nicely in the comic, in that it's respectful and also observant. And also interesting is that, I mean, he would make something and then something would happen and he would either get thrown out of that endeavor, or he would move somewhere else, or he had to do some silly, stupid stuff, you know. Or it can be argued he invented the Village Voice with an index card on his first day in New York, because he worked for a number of papers in London and Canada. And he was also a radio transcriptionist, I think, for, you know, like the guy who would write the news copy for somebody to read.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved to New York with the idea to start a paper. Or rather, John doesn't deal well with time. And so he moved to New York for the excitement of it. But then New York itself had to have some utility to him, for him. You know, it had to have a purpose. It couldn't just be you're going to New York and being around people. And so he wrote on a index card in the Greenwich Village, you know, if anybody else was interested in making a paper like that. And there was already The Villager, but I think that, which was its own paper, but I think John, as a reporter, kind of looked at it and saw it as like a really soft kind of, just this ineffective publication. And so he put out this call for writers. And then you were talking earlier about sort of like the money of the counter, you know, money of the counterculture. An idea is nothing without investors. And so a lot of John's experiences are actually providing ideas, and then the investor and the money kind of controls it, and then he gets kind of kicked out of it. And that definitely happened with the Village Voice. So if you look at the Village Voice front page, his name is the only one on the front cover for the first issue. But you know, he didn't get along well with Norman Mailer, which is one of the funnier parts of that. If you read the comic, their dysfunction together is, I think, one of the early high points of the comic. But And we had a lot of fun with that. Scott drew an amazing, the page is like old Norman Mailer haunts young Norman Mailer, and it's sort of this.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I'm remembering it. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And the artwork is so incredible and seems so real. I mean, how did you guys, you know, research this? It's not just John's story, but it's like there's detail in it that make it a sort of more of a reported piece.
Yeah, thank you so much. John's story is sort of like the anchor for things, but we go in a lot of different places on this comic, with John sort of just being the metronome for it, you know, and we have our own stories from the 60s that we want to include in it. Each chapter is sort of broken up into a single year from John's, the full title of the book is John Wilcock, New York Years, and right now it's looking like 1954 through about 1972. We originally said 1971, but it might go to 1972. But each chapter is that one year. And if you think about like any time in history, there are very few decades other than the 60s that have such a distinct timeline on itself. You know, so when we were thinking about like how do we structure this book into something that actually has like kind of like a shape to it, the 60s have like a perfect story shape. You know, I mean, the early 60s, it sort of inherits the 50s in this odd sense, and then it sort of goes through its own adolescence, you know, and tragedy with Kennedy, and then civil rights, and tragedy with civil rights with ML, you know, Martin Luther King, and then also then drugs, and it's got its own perfect shape to it. So we address each year. Scott and I have sort of like a story meeting every new chapter, because these things also are extremely exhausting. You know, each chapter is only 12 or 15 pages, but it's as much comics as we can do. I mean, it's really, really tough stuff. And I can describe sort of the process on each page, if that helps.
Sure.
It starts with sort of like this existing interview that I have with John. And Don would then still, up until he had a stroke a number of years ago, so it's not as available or easy to do now as it was. But it used to be then I would have like sort of like a follow up with John about some things, and he would be, his amount of recall was really good for like, well, you know, that would apply to this newspaper that I worked on, or oh yeah, you should probably email this person or whatever. So he would kind of facilitate the kind of thing you can't research, you know, the actual experience. But then he and I have a funny rule, because nobody would remember verbatim exchanges with people. So if he doesn't remember certain dialogue, I get to write it or make it, you know. And so that's like a funny agreement. But then I'll find some stuff out that doesn't really apply to his experience. It's wonderful. Like a great example being that he would remember, yeah, I saw that he saw, you know, after an absence due to, he lost his cabaret card. That was John's memory. And so I knew the other half of that, which was his heroin arrest. And so we would sort of like combine that into a piece. And so John has the experience of seeing Monk, and then we would also sort of give some backstory on the heroin arrest. And so we would research that and compress it into 9 or 10 panels, which is really tough. You know, by the way, comics are really, really difficult, because there's this rule of you never want to say something you can't show, and you never want to show something you can't say. So like perfect comics are ones that only use text to say something that you can't draw, and the other way around. And so, but the process on the way these comics get made is that I'll make like a pretty extensive breakdown of the page that will indicate, you know, what the images should be at the scale that they should be and where the dialogue should be. And then I'll pass it to Scott, who has this real gift for caricature, really sarcastic pen. You know, he's a wickedly talented person. And the one thing I could say about his illustrations before he and I worked together on these comics is that there wouldn't be this sort of scale alignment. You know, like certain design stuff in the way that he would draw wouldn't as perfectly as in a comic sense, you know, like a comic book sense, in that your eye needs to sort of like move around the page. And so I would help give him sort of like some scale consistency with things. And then he sends in the art, and then I'll tighten it up again, and then do the lettering. And this sounds like a long process. I'm sorry about this.
No, that's quite all right.
So then I'll get the art from him, and then I'll paste it up on the page, and then move it around again and crop things and sort of tighten it up into being a comic. And then add lettering. I do the lettering in the word balloons, and then I do the first coat of color, and then Scott will then. So it's kind of like a baking process, you know, like we have the script, we put it in, he sends it back with the art. I send it back with the tightened up with the first coat of color, and then he'll send it back with the highlights. And so it's a huge amount of work just to get one page done.
Well, how long does it take you to do a chapter then?
A long time.
That's an easy answer.
I can answer that. We were thinking we could get the whole thing done. Okay, so you're approaching. I hope you heard the pain in my voice when I said a long time.
Because you're still on deadline, I'm sure.
We're still on it. But, I mean, so like the joke would be, we have joked that we just want to be able to. Okay, so for doing a story that's like 12 years in John's life or something, you know, we hope that it'll take that, that we can do 2 years. We'd hope that we could get the whole thing done in 5 years, but it actually looks like we can get about 2 years or two chapters done a year. And we just want to actually keep in pace of real. We don't want this to take more than 17 years. You know, we don't want to take more than a year on a year.
Oh my God. So how far are you in it?
We are at 1966 now. Which is finally where, you know, humorously, it's kind of like, I remember looking at 66 and 65 and I was like, well, hot dog, that's when we really should have started, you know, but the backstory is really terrific. And yeah, so we've got, I think like 5 years.
Yeah.
Or 5 chapters ago.
Yeah. I've read the first 3 chapters. It's just wonderful stuff. Now, is it, it's all online now or?
Yeah, well, actually, so ad advertisement number 2. So ad 1, there's the Real Cartoons, collection from Fantagraphics. And then if you go to the website at my website, which I wanted the shortest URL possible when I made the URL. So my website is ep.tc. and then slash Wilcock. You can see everything that we posted there, either there, the first three chapters that you mentioned, or also the website Boing Boing, wonderful website, has serialized pretty much every page since then. You can then we have a print book of the first chapter, or the first book, we call it book one, which is years 1954 through 1963, and that's available for purchase right there. It looks great.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to order. I'm definitely going to order that. So I think we got a sense that you still got a lot of work to do on this, and it's carrying you.
Well, a lot of joy, though. I mean, you know, the Realist Archive was its own kind of like, oh my God, I still got a lot of work to do on that, because that was four issues a month. And it took, I think it was its own process of about like 6 or 10 years to complete. And you kind of have to make this agreement with yourself that this is like one of your projects and it's going to definitely be the biggest thing you're working on for that time. But there's a lot of joy and pride in working on a long thing.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Ethan, this has been great. I really enjoyed our conversation. Definitely going to get the book. Looking forward to reading the rest of what you've got. Say again your website so people can find your stuff.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you. It is, if you just look up my name, it'll show up immediately. And then the website is just a four letter URL. It's ep.tc.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and now the Podcast One platform. This week's podcast was produced by Nicola Grisco, web editor Amber Healy, and me, your host, Michael O'Connell. It's All Journalism is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.
The What's Working in Washington podcast with your host, Jonathan Aberman.
We share this region's innovative, entrepreneurial, and creative spirit. This podcast tells impressive stories of passion and spunk taking place here in the D.C. region. It illustrates how the nation's capital is anything but the stuffy bureaucratic politics-only reputation it tries to shed.
The What's Working in Washington podcast. Find it on iTunes, the Podcast One app, podcastone.com, or at WTOP.com. Search Podcast DC.